VR and immersive augmented experiences are just technologies that augment our perceptual reality, which is already a virtual experience.
That's pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah. See, once you get to experience this, there's no birth, there's no death. Birth and death are human constructs for a software program that is projecting a perceptual activity as a virtual reality. What's projecting is you.
Mm-hmm.
That you is not in time because you can't be located.
Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. This is a special episode recorded at the Milken Conference in Abu Dhabi in United Arab Emirates. And this is really cool because Deepak Chopra and I shared a panel earlier and I said, hey, let's do an episode of Bulletproof Radio. Deepak, I've been wanting to interview you for a long time. I've been a fan of your work, I think, since at least number 70 of your 89 or 90 books you've written so far. And you've really changed the world of awareness. So it's a real honor to have you on the show. Thank you for making time.
Thank you.
I almost feel like I don't need to introduce you because anyone who listens to Bulletproof Radio already knows of your work.
Good.
But if someone didn't, you're a leading physician and an expert in consciousness who's really helped bring our attention at the highest levels of society and just at broad levels into our awareness, as well as the health and nutrition and anti-aging things you've done. But your new book, the one that I wanted to talk about today, MetaHuman, is really interesting. Even the title kind of blows my mind. And let's just get into it. What is a MetaHuman?
Meta means beyond. And human, in this case, refers to the human mind. So MetaHuman is what is beyond the human mind. It's a deeper exploration of what I've always explored in my life, which is what is fundamental reality, although that's becoming a little clearer now. So, you know, when I, as a physician, fundamental reality for me was the physical world and the physical body. And I trained as a physician. So everything that you know about the body in terms of matter, genomics, molecular biology, etc., etc. Somewhere along the line, I realized that I could, and as a treating physician, also as a neuroendocrinologist, I realized that you could have two people who had the same illness, same doctor, same treatment, and they could have completely different outcomes. And it's like a bell-shaped curve outcome. Some people survive, some die, and then some have symptoms in between, chronic illness, sometimes well, etc. So I kind of realized that, you know, treating the body as a physical machine didn't work. And then I got into what we now call mind-body medicine because of my research in neuropeptides. I was looking at the brain, brain chemistry, immune function, immunomodulation. And so it became my career kind of veered off into mind-body medicine, which then got into integrative medicine, which is lifestyle, etc. But right now, what I'm exploring in MetaHuman is that the physical world is not real, and nor is the mental world real. What we call the physical world, like you're looking out of this window and you see Abu Dhabi, or, you know, you could be in Bahrain or New York City, you think that's real. And this microphone is real. Your body is real. It's not so. What we call the physical world is a species-specific perceptual activity in human consciousness. So the world that you see out there is not the world, say, a chameleon looks at, because the eyeballs of a chameleon swivel on two different axes. You can't even remotely imagine what that world is. There are butterflies, for example, that smell the world through their antenna, taste the world through their legs, hear the world through their wings. The wings are the auditory apparatus. And their eyes, they have 30,000 lenses that move like a kaleidoscope, giving presumably the butterfly an experience of shimmering colors, shapes, forms that you and I can't even remotely imagine, because the butterfly experiences ultraviolet, which is not an experience for you and me, and other bandwidths of perceptual activity. which we can't remotely imagine. We can't even imagine the colors that they see. Mm. Okay, so in reality, there are infinite forms, infinite perceptual experiences, and humans have a tendency to reify their experiences. All you're experiencing right now, and all the people who are listening to us, are experiencing, in terms of sound, noise. In terms of vision, color, shapes, and forms. Mm. The rest is a human story, body, mind, universe. So when you look at the Milky Way galaxy at night, what is really happening is sensations, images, perceptions, and thoughts are being modified into that experience, which you and I call the Milky Way galaxy out there, but is actually occurring in human consciousness. And human consciousness is one tributary of an infinite consciousness.
When I went to Nepal and Tibet to learn about meditation from some of the masters there years ago, I got into a discussion with one of the monks. And as you know, as our audience may not know, a highly passionate debate is a part of the tradition there. And they're trained in that since they're children. So you can ask any question you want without being offensive.
Of course.
And I said, look, how can we agree that this chair is here? Because you can make a case that this chair isn't really here, a case much like the one you just made. Well, different things sense it different ways. If you look between the atoms, it's mostly not there. It's full of space. So how do we establish to discuss anything in reality if nothing's really there and it's all based on the perception of who sees it? How do we actually have an objective discussion about anything?
Okay, so look at a chair. And before you call it a chair, it's an experience. Mm-hmm. You can't have a chair without an experience. In our case, it's a human experience, okay? So instead of calling it a chair, I call it an experience. Then ask yourself, where is the experience happening? Okay, where is the experience of the chair happening? Okay, and that's the same. Where's the experience of this microphone happening or this hand happening?
It's only in your head, because if you're not looking at it.
Where is the knowing of the head happening? How do you know there's a head? Okay, mm-hmm. How do you know there's a brain? Where is that knowing happening? So when we say awareness is the common ground of all experience, a mosquito's experience, a butterfly's experience, a tree's experience, it has to be aware before it responds to the world. Okay. We now know that trees communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Honeybees go to a grove, come back and do something called a waggle dance, and every other honeybee knows exactly where to go to find that flavor of honey. So they're all having different experiences in a species-specific branch of an infinite consciousness.
Okay.
Now, you and I agree that's a chair, because when you were born, you didn't think it was a chair. You didn't think at all. All you were experiencing were shapes, colors, and forms and sensations. Your parents told you that's a chair. Okay, that experience in consciousness then reified itself. Reified means it became something concrete as a reality, but in fact it wasn't. In fact, every experience, even these words and this experience, it's a discontinuity, which means every time I look at you and look away and look at you again, I'm taking a snapshot, like a selfie or something like that. What creates continuity in the movie that we call the world is the presence of consciousness.
Okay.
So consciousness gives continuity to perceptual snapshots. Humans have language to express that, and they use different languages with the same meaning. So once you imbue an experience with a meaning, it becomes a world. It becomes an object.
Okay.
That chair is an object. We agree. But before it's an object and an experience, the experience is perceptual activity, not in the brain, because the brain is also a perceptual activity in consciousness. How do you know there's a brain? Why? Because you experience it, not in the brain. Brain has no experience, by the way. This is the biggest misconception. Ask any neuroscientist who knows what they're talking about. If I put a knife through the brain, it doesn't feel anything. Okay, so brain doesn't feel pain, it doesn't feel pleasure, it doesn't feel anything. All the brain represents is what are called neural correlates of experience, NCEs. And these are symbolic representations in the same way as this video is, in the same way as a book is. When I read Shakespeare, Shakespeare is not in the ink. but I experienced Shakespeare's consciousness in the ink. So everything you see is a symbolic representation of your real self, which is a conscious agent. Now, in spiritual traditions, they call that the soul. It's not a word that cognitive scientists are comfortable with. So they call it a conscious agents. So we are in a matrix of conscious agents collectively projecting the universe, the human universe, not a butterfly universe, not a snake universe, not a bat universe.
So we have this idea of an observer effect.
And, correct.
You know, quantum, in quantum science, the real quantum science, not the kind of
flaky,
out there.
Yeah.
Flaky, thank you, that's the right word. When you observe something, or say when something is observed, because what's observing is different, it collapses into reality. Now, if a butterfly observes the chair and I observe the chair, which one makes it collapse into reality?
This is a question that should be really addressed very seriously, very seriously, because most people, when you ask them, where is the observer? They say it's somewhere here in my head or in my brain. So the observer is a is thought to be embodied.
Mm-hmm.
The observer is not embodied. The observer is non-local. It has no location in space-time. The body, the mind, the brain, and the universe are a unified collapse in the observer. And the observer, furthermore, is species-specific, non-local, which means it's infinite, but it can modulate itself into the experience of a butterfly or a human being or a chimpanzee or a tree. Now, the collapse, therefore, simultaneously creates, right now, the collapse function is creating this, all this, and what I'm thinking about it and what you're thinking about it. So where is that observer? You would say it's here, but here where? No location in space or time. The space-time experience occurs as soon as the collapse occurs, but the observer is not embodied. The embodiment experience is part of the collapse. Am I clear on this or not?
The embodiment experience is part of the collapse.
Yeah,
I don't
because,
think I get
see,
that
the observer, right new you, the observer, Dave Asprey, is observing itself.
Okay.
Limited. You can't see your back.
Right,
you
right.
can't see your brain. But you're observing it, your body, right?
Okay.
You're also observing me. You're also aware of this environment. You're also aware of this.
Okay.
You're also aware of your thoughts and you're trying to read my facial expressions to read my thoughts. Where is this entity? It can't be found in the body. Okay, now if I do a brain scan or CAT scan or MRI, I can see the neural correlates of that experience, just like I can see the symbolic signatures of Shakespeare by reading Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can have your audience right now may be in Africa or India, they can have this experience, right? So actually our technology is taking us slowly into where is the observer? Observer can't be found in the body, which means, you know, these days you hear all this thing about out-of-body experience. The actual mystery is how do we get an in-body experience? Because you're not in the body. The body is an experience in you.
Okay.
The mind is an experience in you. The universe is an experience in you, and the you that is having the experience is not in space-time, which means it's infinite, eternal, not subject to birth and death. Birth and death is happening in this moment. Every thought is born, dies. Every cell is born, dies. Your stomach cell die every 5 days. Your skin cells die every month. There's a program, a software program. Your skeleton recycles every 3 months. Even DNA, which records millions or you might say hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary memory, the actual raw material, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen.
It gets recycled frequently.
Keeps getting recycled. So what is recycling this and where is the recycling happening? What is orchestrating it? And
it
this is,
revealed.
For lack of a better word, we say consciousness or awareness, which means the same thing. Now there's conscious awareness, which is this, but there's unconscious awareness, which is in deep sleep, for example. Or there's other kinds of awareness in dreams. As you delve deeper into the nature of reality, what I call meta-reality in the book, you find that there are infinite experiences to be had and their frequency domains of consciousness. actually in many ways are physical science, like string theory, eternal inflation, multiverses. Collapse is avoided in some of these theories because collapse creates both the subject and the object of experience. So these theories are going in that direction, but they postulate infinite universes, all physical. And what I'm saying here, which is consistent with some of the mm-hmm. latest theories, is they're not physical. They are frequency domains of consciousness. There's a good book by this, since you're interested in this.
Yeah.
The best current science on this is Donald Hoffman, who's a cognitive scientist at UC Irvine. His new book, which takes, you know, my book is both philosophical and scientific and
right.
theoretical, but his book is purely science, pure science. He discusses evolutionary biology and everything. His book is called The Case Against Reality.
Yes.
Okay, and it's a brilliant mm-hmm. book because what it tackles is what philosophers of science call naive realism. Now, you know, it's not meant to be insulting, but Einstein was a naive realist. So were all the pioneers of science, except for maybe Niels Bohr and Max Planck.
Some
and
of them
few.
Are pretty mystical when you
research
Yeah,
Schrodinger. Yeah. These guys were not physicalists. But what is naive realism? Only two principles. The physical world exists exactly as perceived by the five human senses. Now, that obviously is not true because there are other species having different experiences, right? The second principle of naive realism is the physical world would exist even if there was no consciousness to observe it. Now, this has a famous history. You know, Einstein, when he was walking the grounds of Princeton one day, it was, I think, walking the grounds of Princeton somewhere, but he remarked, "I don't think the moon would exist if no one was looking at it." So he was actually postulating what we today call physicalism or naive realism. But he was wrong. The moon that you and I experience is a totally human experience. There are crabs in the depths of the ocean that have no experience of light whatsoever. And yet on the full moon night, they come to the surface and they mate.
So they are having magnetism or something.
Something.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are they experiencing that even informs their reproductive biology? Can you imagine? If they didn't have that experience, there wouldn't be any horseshoe crabs. So what is reality? It's infinite, infinite perceptual activities, infinite species-specific mental activities. What's leaky margins? If I don't know if you have a dog or a cat. Okay, so your dog doesn't hear the same sound. What's a dog called?
Merlin.
Huh?
Merlin.
Beautiful name. But when you use the word Merlin, mm-hmm. you have no idea what the sound is
yeah.
or what that experience is, but you still relate because you're both, you as a body mind and your dog are in a virtual reality arcade. And this is brilliant right now because our new technologies are actually showing us that what we are creating as VR and immersive augmented experiences are just technologies that augment our perceptual reality, which is already a virtual experience.
That's pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah.
How?
See, once you get to experience mm-hmm. this, there's no birth, there's no death. These are human constructs. Birth and death are human constructs for a software program that is projecting a perceptual activity as a virtual reality. What's projecting is you.
Mm-hmm.
That you is not in time because you can't be located. You see, that you can't has no location in space-time. It's not in the body. The body is experienced in that you and that consciousness. So again, to make things easy for our audience, consciousness is the knowing element in every experience, whether it's perceptual or mental or emotional or imagination. Any sensation, any perception, any feeling, any thought is constantly bubbling out of consciousness. And we have constructed a physical universe out of it, which is brilliant, actually, because in a way, humans are representing the infinite as yeah. this experience.
You've become a learned person. And I'm curious, how much of what you're sharing with me right now comes from study of spiritual traditions, various ones around the world, because you match what many lineages would tell you, and how much of this is direct experience?
So as I grew up, went to medical school, internship, residency, I didn't think about this at all. My reality was purely physical. Then as I delved deeper into neuroscience and neuropeptides, you know, I became fascinated, you know, because when I was getting my training, it's in the 70s, it was a revolution in science. That we had a technique called radioimmunoassay. We could look at chemicals in the body. I had a colleague, she's passed on since then because of various reasons, unfortunately. She was a neuroscientist like me, neuroendocrinologist. She one day said in a conversation, these things we are looking at in the lab, oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin, these are molecules of emotion.
Was this Candace Pert?
Yeah.
I was guessing you were going to go there.
Okay, so Candace,
I regret that I haven't interviewed her. I couldn't before she passed.
Yeah. So I thought that was brilliant. I said, write a book, Molecules of Emotion.
So you helped her name the book?
I gave her, she came up with the name.
Okay.
I told her to write the book. I wrote the foreword.
I didn't remember that. Okay.
So now what happened is I was so charged, psyched by this experience that, you know, now we have a molecular basis for thought or feeling. I went to a spiritual master in India and very passionately shared this with him. And he smiled and he said, those molecules aren't real. They are human names for an experience.
Wow.
Okay. And I thought about that a lot. Then I delved into Buddhism. Then I delved into Kashmir Shaivism. Then I went straight into Vedanta, the non-dual traditions of the world. At this time, I was deep in meditation. I had many spiritual masters in my 30s,
okay.
Early 30s. Before that, I was smoking and drinking and all of that. You know, it was fashionable to do that as a doctor.
20s,
okay. But now I was in deep meditation and I had many spiritual masters, one in particular, but many. I met many healers that were discounted by modern science, and yet I was trying to figure out what were they doing, because I was seeing changes.
It works.
Yeah, it works. So then I got deeply into the spiritual practice. And for the last, I'm now 73, so I can say unequivocally for the last 40 years, I spend 3-4 hours in meditation every day. I try not to be social, but sometimes you have to be. Other than when I'm working on stage or speaking about a book or doing this, I don't have much of a social life. I have a family, and I'm very close to them. But I've practiced last 30, 40 years going into what I call non-local consciousness. And every night I visualize my death and what that would be as a physical reality. But who's the observer that is watching even the death? Where is that observer? You can't get rid of the observer. You try as hard as you can. The one thing you cannot get rid of is the observer, just like you can't get rid of the space here we're in.
Yeah.
That you can destroy the building, but the space will always be here.
But one of the things that I learned in the course of doing neurofeedback, specifically on myself, but also with clients around trauma, is if you think back to a really scary time in your life, and you imagine what it was like, you'll almost always imagine it like a movie camera up in the corner of the room. Mm-hmm. If your consciousness was in your body, you would only imagine it from your eyes.
Yeah, so that's called God's eye view.
It's a time when you left your body because it was too scary.
Yeah.
But what was the you that left your body?
You were never in the body. The body was always a perceptual activity in you. So, you know, when people say, what happens to us after we die? The answer is you were never born. All you did was take a picnic called the human experience. And, you know, in the Vedanta, infinite universes come and go in the vast expanse of consciousness, like motes of dust dancing in a beam of light. That's a good metaphor.
Do people get mad when you say this?
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't make me mad at all. I'm in alignment with you. But a lot of people say, you know, my children passed away. My parents passed away. Like, oh, the pain. Oh, the suffering. And you're
saying, your children were there, or your father was there, your parents, where was the experiencing experience happening of your children, your father, and your body. That was a perceptual snapshot. You know, I just heard from a nursing student that I knew when she was 19, okay, and I was 23. We had intense conversations about consciousness, brain, this, that, and the other. Then she went off to LA. I was in Boston. I never heard from her, for 42 years. Then suddenly someone gave her my contact information. I heard from her. And I now can see in my awareness that kid that was Deepak Chopra as an intern, and she is a nursing student. It's all a dream. Where is that experience even now as I think of who was that guy that still called Deepak Chopra and this guy? They have no connection to each other. Okay, there's not a single molecule in my body, not a single peptide in my brain, not a single activity atom in my brain that was present in that experience. I learned skating, ice skating, at the age of 7. Then I didn't skate for 40 years. And then I picked up ice skating and went to a rink. I was skating. Where was that memory? Now, if you ask traditional neuroscientists, where is they'll point to the head. But actually, if you ask a really good neuroscientist, where is the memory in the head? Distributed, but as symbolic correlates of experience. The experience is not in the body. Right. The body is just a signature, symbolic, and it's a changing signature because, you know, that body I had as a 20-year-old is not this body. The brain that learned to skate is not the brain that remembers how to skate. So the brain does not remember. You remember, and then you cause the collapse of the wave function that you call a memory. And that causes a signature in the brain. Okay.
From the perspective of your book, MetaHuman, what does our perception of aging do? Is it what's making us age? And if we perceived our bodies as young and strong, would we get younger and stronger? What? Unpack this.
Now, I'm going to talk straight science, and then I'll tell you where the science could go, okay?
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
Now, I'm going to talk straight science, and then I'll tell you where the science could go, okay? But remember, science is a story, just like mythology is a story, and theology is a story, philosophy is a story, religion is a story. Science is a very current, successful modeling of reality. Science does not explore reality. It creates models of reality. You can ask any scientist, they'll agree that science creates models of reality and continues to revise them. Newtonian science, relativity, quantum mechanics, mathematics, all of that improves our models of reality. So if we go with those models and then we can go beyond the models of reality, then the body expresses something that scientists call apoptosis. apoptosis is programmed cellular death.
Right.
So your stomach cells are programmed to die every 5 days so you can create new ones. If this didn't exist, this programmed cellular death, then we would have cancer. Cancer is the loss of the memory of death in the cellular level.
Okay.
So apoptosis is actually meant to protect you. The senescent cells are gone and new cells are created.
Okay.
And there's a program for that. It's a human program in our case, as you said. Up to now, people think it's 120. We can extend it. That's all true. Okay. But that program must be maintained without disturbing the overall integrity of the body, which is an integrated system. My stomach cells are not acting by themselves, nor are my heart cells, nor are my brain cells, nor are my immune cells, nor are my endocrine cells. They're all like an integrated symphony. Okay? Yeah. So if I can prolong this recycling in an integrated manner, then I can extend lifespan and health span as well.
Just with your mind?
No. Mind is one aspect.
Okay,
but yeah, and there are things like, as you know, sleep, managing stress,
eating good stuff,
exercise, mind-body coordination, breathing, on and on. These are all the things that make for a joyful experience of life. Okay. If you don't sleep well, you're not going to be a happy person next day, right?
Yes.
So the signal in your body of whether you're integrated or not is very simple, actually. Do you have all the energy that you need to do everything you want? Do you have all the, are you experiencing a joyful, energetic body right now? Are you experiencing a loving, compassionate heart right now? Are you experiencing a reflective, alert mind right now? Do you have lightness of being? Are you in flow right now? If you can say 10 out of 10 in these four, you're going to have a very good life and a long life. Now, you can do all the things you want to augment that. Take the new short chain peptides, neural hacking, and all of that. As long as it's an integrated into your experience of joy, you can extend this indefinitely, theoretically.
So if you're doing anti-aging because you're afraid of death, it won't work?
It won't work.
Okay, I love that.
No, it won't work.
Okay.
The fear of death, by the way, is ultimately the fear of everything else. So what is the fear of death for most people is the fear of the unknown. Okay, but if the unknown is known to you, if you transcend all systems of thought, because no system of thought can give you access to reality. Systems of thought can create models of reality. So mythology says there's a God, there's something out there, we haven't seen it, but it's there, there are heavens, there are hells, we haven't seen them. You know, but those systems of thought get better and better as we understand the nature of consciousness. Ultimately, though, no system of thought will give you access to reality, not even science. You have to transcend all thought.
Because thought is just a model.
Okay. Thought creates models.
One of the things I did in my 30s, you know, I went and I did the trip to Nepal, Tibet, and did all sorts of really deep personal discovery work. And I decided that, okay, everything ultimately comes down to fear of death, which many traditions will teach you.
It's the basis of all religion.
Yeah. And I said, all right, I'm going to choose to believe in reincarnation. I come from a family of atheists, or fallen Catholic atheists. And I said, I'm going to choose to believe in reincarnation because that's relaxing. Because then if I die, I didn't really die. I'm getting to start over and play something else. But if I'm wrong, I'm not going to know it. So it was one of those you can't lose by doing that. And I actually think it really did at the time reduce fear of death. And I don't walk around with fear of death as a part of my reality now.
So let me tell you.
Good idea, bad idea.
It's a good idea, but you can go even beyond the idea. So here's how you think about it. If you look at religious experience, not religious ideology.
Okay, just the experience.
The religious experience. Jesus Christ, Buddha, Muhammad, anyone, actually. More than...
Yeah, there's many.
There's many. There are three things that stand out. One is... somehow, they transcended thought. Okay, now you can postulate how. Were they microdosing or taking whatever? You know,
soma.
Was it in the fungus or is it soma or whatever? Or they somehow transcended all models of reality. That was number one. Number two, they had, as a result of that experience of the infinite, remember, the infinite cannot be conceptualized. That's why we use symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we create images of God because we can't actually, we cannot create a model of infinity.
Okay.
And yet mathematicians do it all the time. They use zeros and this, and they're very happy because now they've got a, you know, a symbol for it.
You can do math with the signature.
Yeah, now I can do postulate eternal inflation, right. Collapse of the wave function, multiple universes, all because I have these symbols.
Right.
Okay, so I can postulate. It's pretty neat that only humans can do that, number mm-hmm. one. So the thing that happened to these great, we call them prophets or sages or luminaries, is number one, they transcended models. Number two, as a result of the experience of what can only be called infinite, they had the emergence of what we today might call Platonic values, truth, goodness, beauty, harmony, love, compassion, joy, equanimity, not as moral injunctions, which becomes hypocrisy with the halo. You know, it was their natural way of being. And number three, equally important, they lost the fear of death. Now, this is amazing. You know, if I can have that experience, that religious experience, where I transcend all models, well, I feel love, compassion, joy, equanimity, and peace, and I have no fear of death. Well, what more can I want? Now, coming to reincarnation. Everything recycles. We know that, right? We do now have recycling plants for plastic.
Sure.
Okay. There's nothing that doesn't recycle. Energy recycles, information recycles, what we call matter recycles. And all these are human constructs in human consciousness. Why would consciousness be the only thing that doesn't recycle? Okay. So then, of course, people say, if I was Cleopatra in my last lifetime, which a lot of people think they are, why don't I remember it? And I would ask you, do you remember your 14th birthday or what you were doing last Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon? And unless you were having champagne with your girlfriend and she said, I'm in love with you and will you marry me, and
right.
you passionately kissed her, you'd have no idea what you were doing last Tuesday. Thank God, because if you did, your mind would... There are people, by the way, who have pathologies where they remember everything that happened to them every day of their life.
Like my wife, I think. Oh, okay. She remembers all the bad stuff I did. Okay.
So there are people who remember that and they are tortured. Okay, so memory is both an advantage and a torturer. People are tortured by their memories. They go see psychotherapists memories. So the saying in spirituality is, I use memories, but I don't allow memories to use me. I choose the memories that I want to experience right now so I can make choices to create even better memories in the future. But the fact that you don't remember something doesn't mean it didn't exist. You have no memory of being an embryo. You have no memory of being, of even learning the English language, but you did. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this conversation. You have no memory of walking, but you learned how to walk.
Okay,
so everything that we do now, we learned, including how we interpret perception, that chair. We learned. Perception is a learned phenomenon. Human beings have become amazingly good at this because, you know, you go to school, you learn math, you learn everything, you learn history, etc., and then you create models of reality, and then you confuse yourself with a model that you call my body and my mind when everything is actually recycling on its own. And that's who you are. That's what is recycling. So reincarnation, now, of course, if you look at science and scientific validation is very important for people. You can look at infants, or not infants, young kids, toddlers, who recall other lifetimes that you can actually go and validate. Okay, you have this 6-year-old kid who says, I was a pilot, I was in the Second World War, this was the model of my plane, I was shot down over, you know... over the islands of Hawaii, I was a prisoner, I was rescued. 6-year-old kid saying this. And you go and look at the history and the model, and there it is. So those who want to research this, and open eye, not the skeptics, because actually even the skeptics, not the cynics. Cynics skeptics are already made up their mind, but skeptics have an open mind, then you'll see there's a lot of substantiation for that.
There really is. There's enough that I don't worry about my belief in reincarnation. Yeah,
the one that worries, by the way, mm-hmm. is not you. The one that worries is your conditioned mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair point.
Yeah. Okay, the one that worries is independent of all this. It's just having a good time creating universes.
And my models are probably wrong for lots of things. They're just better than a lot of other
people's
models.
Every model is subject to revision.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
Let's talk about that. You once said aging is optional. Like we don't have to age. And that was quite a few years ago. You're 73 now.
Yeah.
Has that model changed?
No. I think actually my model was limited by concepts, structures like the Hayflick limit.
Yeah.
The cells can only divide. Right. This is a program. And I've realized since then that every model is subject to revision. But if you ask me, do I want to experience eternity as this? No, because I've been changing this all along anyway. So, you know, there's a poem by Rumi. It says, when I die, I shall soar with angels. And when I die to the angels, what I shall become, you cannot imagine. Because the possibilities are infinite. Consciousness imagines itself into existence. Consciousness conceives, constructs, imagines, governs, and becomes what it imagines.
Now, when you do finally pass at some point like that, there's also
body-mind transits, yes.
The body-mind transits, but here's a question for you. The Egyptians made mummies. Some people freeze themselves in cryonics. Other people do Tibetan sky burials. So I've seen relics in Nepal from enlightened masters, you know, who were burned for 4 days and still little jawbones are left. So what is the method of that you would like to choose? Whenever you do pass, what's the best way for the physical body to pass?
So in my tradition, there's something called Mahasamadhi. Maha means big. Samadhi means the big meditation. Mm-hmm. And I know people from my personal experience who actually chose the moment of death.
Yeah,
consciously and died in meditation. Many people I know who are not famous have done that. My own father, at the age of 80-something, mid-80s, he kind of said, I've had a good innings, had a good life. I think I should celebrate. And then, you know, one day in the middle of the night, he got up, he wished goodbye to my mother. And said, you know, I think I don't have enough time. And he went to the other room, said, give the kids goodbye, closed his eyes, and okay, now I know a lot of people who've gone through that experience.
It's very possible.
Okay, so at the very least, I would like to have Mahasamadhi in good health.
That way.
Or I would, you know, have you heard of the rainbow body in Tibetan? So enlightened Tibetan masters, you can find some examples
I'll
of
look
this.
Look
it up on YouTube. Okay. And there'll be some fake videos and there'll be some real ones, maybe. But in that tradition, the enlightened master, when they take Mahasamadhi, within 24 hours or 48 hours, the body spontaneously undergoes combustion and all that's left is a few fingernails and hair and some relics. And now that is even beyond Mahasamadhi.
Now, for those of us who don't combust and leave relics, and I'm happy to sign up to learn how to do that. It's going to take me a little while. But for the rest of us, does it matter what happens to your physical meat after you die? Does it matter what happens to your body?
No, because it was never there in the first place. Everything is recycled.
It's a husk. It's a shell.
Yeah, it's a signature. It's a footprint. It's a symbolic representation of a lifetime. That's it. And even the body is a symbolic representation of experience in consciousness. And that experience is non-local. In fact, this experience right now, we think it's happening in Dubai, or no, in Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's happening in consciousness. Dubai is a human construct, just like latitude and longitude is a human construct.
Right.
Or money is a human construct. Mm-hmm. You know, you say money. Okay, who created money? Okay, who created Wall Street? Who created latitude and longitude? Who created Greenwich Mean Time? Why not Botswana Mean Time? Okay, now we agree on these constructs. And then we embed ourselves in the construct, including the construct that I am a physical being, when actually I'm a spiritual being having the human experience, which we agree is called physicality, but there's no such thing.
In MetaHuman, you're called a people. It is pretty straightforward. It's that to become a MetaHuman, you've got to become aware.
Aware of experience, aware of the interpretation of the experience, aware of the awareness in which that experience is happening. So if I asked you right now, are you aware? And the answer is, of course, you're aware. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this conversation. But normally, our awareness is telescopic, right? You just mentioned that. When you imagine yeah. from somewhere there. That's the so actually, all experience is happening non-locally. The interpretation is it's happening locally because we invented the name Abu Dhabi for this experience, mm-hmm. the latitude and longitude, and everything about it is our creation.
Okay. The idea of a non-local consciousness used to actually really piss me off when I was a young computer scientist. And after enough exploration of Eastern traditions and shamanism and things like that, I became very comfortable with the idea that some portion of my consciousness, at least, is non-local.
And all of it is non-local.
Okay.
It is localizing as experience.
Okay. I'm willing to go there.
That's where, yeah. even in science today, mm-hmm. the ultimate reality in science, good models, quantum field, it's non-local. You know, yeah. it's actually the ultimate singularity, whatever we call it, black hole, mm-hmm. Singularity, space-time, energy, matter disappears into infinite possibilities. Okay? Yeah. And then those infinite possibilities recycle a space-time, energy, information, and matter in this theater of space-time and causality where we look at objects and we look at ourselves as physical objects in this theater that we call the world. But actually, the whole thing is being projected from the singularity.
Okay.
Holographically. Now, that is close to a scientific model, but it's not the reality. It's, you know, you can't create a model of reality. You can create a model of reality, but it's still a model.
Right.
Okay? Now, non-locality, or what is called entanglement these days, or superposition, that's a scientific fact. Is it consciousness is where people get stuck? Okay. The fact that that we live in a non-local universe, that the universe is non-local, that there is what we call non-local correlation in the universe, entanglement, superposition, all these eternal inflation, cosmic inflation, super strings, these are very good models. But they don't include consciousness, even though they were created in consciousness. Mm. You know, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
That the models were created in consciousness. But, you know, when you say singularity, most people don't think of non-local consciousness. They think of singularity because that's the way the math has created that model. And it's very interesting that everything that we call matter is molecules in the model. Mm. Molecules is atoms in the model. Atoms is particles in the model. And particles don't exist until they're measured. What are they before? You ask scientists, good scientists, I work with a lot of them. So what is a particle, unobserved particle? They'll say it's Schrödinger's wave,
it's a wave
equation.
Form, right? Yeah.
So where is that? It's in Hilbert space. What is Hilbert space? It's a mathematical space which has infinite dimensions or zero dimensions. Make your choice. But where is it? And the answer will get, shut up and calculate. We just know the calculation works. So they don't go beyond that. If you want a career in science, if you want to be, you know, a professor, you want your next grant, you don't talk about these things which sound mystical or spiritual or, you know, weird. So very few people other than Don Hoffman, and there are mm-hmm. a few people,
yeah.
including Roger Penrose and many
others.
Usually
at the end of their careers they do it.
Yeah,
because there's less risk.
There's less risk, yeah. So they say, the singularity could be consciousness, but they won't say is consciousness. Doesn't matter. Even the model of the singularity isn't consciousness. You can't, as Max Planck said, you cannot get behind consciousness. Mm. It is without cause. It is irreducible. It is non-local. It is orchestrating every experience in every species. And we are having a particular bandwidth of experience. Now, we can transcend that both through technology, which we're doing, mm-hmm. through VR, augmented reality, but we can transcend that by going deep into our own self through either reflective inquiry or mindful awareness of perceptual activity or mindful awareness of bodily sensations or breath, or then ultimately transcending all that. Where is this happening? And that is also part of traditional non-dual teachings. We've actually been doing now papers. We have one accepted in a journal of complementary medicine on the science of non-duality. Wow. You know, you have to use these terms science because you're talking to science, but right. Ultimately it's not science. It's the scientist's consciousness that is creating the models. And before you say science says this, you should ask who's the scientist, what is the scientist, and what is the basis of this theory? Because all theories are conceived in consciousness.
Yeah.
All models are constructed in consciousness. All experiments are designed in consciousness. And all observations are made in consciousness.
Mm. I've often thought there's two kinds of science. There's science with a little s, which is inquiry, which ultimately you start asking questions about consciousness. And then there's science with a big S, which is a set of religious dogmatic principles that thou shalt not cross. And so people can say, I'm a scientist, but you have to really ask, are you a big S or a little s?
Yeah.
Is that inaccurate?
Yeah, but that's very accurate, yeah. Science is a good story. It creates, you know, mm-hmm. I was once giving a lecture. I had written a book with Leonard Mlodinow now, who is the co-writer of, he was co-author of Stephen Hawking and all his books. And now that Stephen is gone and other people are gone, I can tell you this in public that Richard Dawkins, the militant atheist and evolutionary biologist, mm-hmm. actually called Stephen Hawking's daughter and said, your co-author is working with a charlatan, a fraud. And Stephen Hawking had his daughter call Leonard and say, you know, if you, Leonard, if you ask him, he's a little embarrassed about this, but they said, if you write this book with him, you probably won't be invited to Stephen's 70th birthday. Leonard said, you know, I don't know if Deepak, one thing I know about Deepak, he's not a charlatan, and I enjoy working with him. I don't agree with him at all. So we wrote this book together mm-hmm. called War of the World Views. Uh-huh. Okay, and his book was all about physical science, and mine was who or what is doing the physical science. And so we ended up in Science of Consciousness in Sweden at the place where they give the Nobel Prizes. And in Karolinska. I gave the talk, Leonard gave a talk, then we had a debate. And so one of the guys, probably some Nobel laureate sitting in the front, he said, excuse me, Deepak Chopra, how did you get here? I said, I took a plane. He said, you trust your life with with science and then you attacked its models. Okay. And he got a applause, standing ovation, and I was the subject of ridicule mm-hmm. because I took a plane trusting science, and I'm now saying science is not adequate to give us a view into reality. I mean, of course, it's
models
not.
Models can be useful, models, but not entirely
they're
accurate. Useful.
They're not yeah. accurate, and I'm not trusting my life. I'm trusting the experience of the body-mind to science, not my life. My life is infinite, timeless, eternal, and not bound by any experience I have.
Okay.
Now, this is another important point for people. The experience and the awareness of experience are related but independent. So if you say, right now you're having the experience of me and the microphone and this conversation, okay? You're not attached to it. After it's finished, you go have your lunch and maybe call your significant other or whatever, and this will be gone. But if you identify with this experience permanently, then you're in a trap, okay? Because you think this experience is reality, but this is actually a perceptual activity constantly changing. You can't even hold on to it. So who or what is having this experience? The very fact I can put attention in my toes and then think of the Empire State Building means the me is independent of the experience of the Empire State Building and of my toes.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay. I love these conversations. I feel like we could talk for hours, and I think a lot of listeners would probably like that. But I'm curious, from the perspective of MetaHuman, I mean, clearly, we can all read the book. How much how much time, how much investment of energy, how long does it take to become metahuman?
None.
Okay. None. Is that because time doesn't exist?
Yes. And you have to get in touch with that part of you, which is timeless. And you know, some people take it, it's very fascinating to me. It's like a fruit that's ripening and then one day it drops. Okay. It was the time. And then reality is no longer what you thought it was. Now, some people tap into it in a fragmented way. Artistic savants, mathematical geniuses, musical geniuses. Actually, now that I'm so intrigued by this, I actually look at these anomalies. I know a kid now who can read his mother's thoughts. So he looks, he's on a computer, mother is reading a book in the back, and he doesn't have access to what she's reading. And I have given the mother letters to read, numbers to read, actually even nursery rhymes or whatever, stories to read. He's typing them on the computer with a little difficulty because he has mind-body dysfunction, autism, etc. But he's typing out exactly what she's doing. So finally I went to him. I said, how do you do it? Simple kid. He says, I love my mother so much, I can get inside her consciousness and then I see what she sees and I type it out. For him, it's not a big deal. Now, of course, he has very limited access to this reality because he's on the spectrum and other realities are edited out for him. So, you know, there's a very kind of thin line between savants, geniuses, psychotics, sages, and enlightened masters. And those who are experimenting with LSD, they're all in the same motley group.
Is that something that you've experimented with?
I was 17 in medical school. I had with kids from Harvard Medical School, we'd had some very intense psychedelic experiences in the 70s. This is when it was big, you know, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, etc. Yeah, in the 70s in medical school. And then later a little bit of shamanic rituals and all of that. So yeah, I'm very familiar with what they do to the default mode network and all the stuff that happens in the brain. Bottom line, they get rid of the models.
Get rid of the models.
That's it.
I have a question about appropriate use of those substances, and then we'll wrap up the show because I know you've got a deadline. I'm seeing some people who are saying I've done 100 ayahuasca journeys, or I'm doing. At what point do you say it's not working? What's the appropriate dosing frequency to go on one of these journeys, whether it's, you know, LSD or mushrooms?
I think even one good experience is good enough. You know, whether it's mushrooms or psilocybin or ayahuasca or whatever. Some people who have a lot of brain trauma and repressed memories are tortured by them, maybe more. Personally, would say either with a very traditional shamanic expert or these days, you know, you have psychotherapists with very good training that I know who work at universities and have grants to look at this stuff.
Someone
and it's a big
well
revolution.
Trained.
Yeah.
Okay. Beautiful. Deepak, I appreciate your 90th book, Metahuman. I appreciate your time and your work and your willingness to go out there and say things that are on the edge of what we know and be willing to face critics who say whatever.
And then I'll soon be dead and they can say all they want.
Well said. Thank you for being on Bulletproof Radio. It's really an honor.
It was great to be with you. Thank you, Dave.
If you liked today's episode, you know what I'm going to ask you to do. Go read Metahuman. Why? Because it's worth your time. As a matter of fact, it's not worth your time because your time doesn't really exist, but still you should read it.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.